You know how there seem to be a lot of union drives at coffee shops, craft breweries, and artisanal bakeries these days? And you don't really get it because you always figure that since their products were so much more delicious than their corporate counterparts, they must treat their workers much better too, right? What's up with that? Welcome to the Fingers Podcast. Welcome back to the Fingers Podcast. I'm your host, of course, Dave Infante, also known as the Fearless Fingers Editor, and I'm coming at you from Temporary HQ here in suburban New Jersey. Today, exclusively for Paying Friends of Fingers, that's you, I've got an interview with Benjamin Anderson, a PhD candidate and graduate instructor at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, British Columbia. That's Canada, for those of you keeping track at home, which means the Fingers Podcast is officially, finally, thank God it's Friday, international. Congratulations to all of us. Please give yourself a pat on the back. Ben studies the labor... anyway, I don't know how to transition. Ben, back to Mr. Anderson. Ben studies the labor movement in the so-called contemporary craft sectors, such as breweries, distilleries, coffee houses, and so on. Basically, if it's local, artisanal, or farm-to-table, he's probably researched the conditions of the people that make it. His work has been published in a variety of journals and collections, and he's finishing up his doctorate as we speak. During our recording session in mid-March, Ben and I got into a ton of tactical and philosophical questions about the labor movement's role in the craft brewing business, including the unique challenges of unionizing small shops, how the "we're all one family" myth at work keeps many employees from realizing their collective power, and ways in which workers of different backgrounds are able to organize based on shared conditions in craft contexts. It was a wide-ranging and super informative conversation, and if you care about worker power or the health of the craft beer business, or presumably both since you're listening to this podcast, I think you'll find it fascinating. I sure hope you do. Before I roll the interview, I just wanted to say one more quick thank you for supporting Fingers with your hard-earned money, the Booze Letter generally, and these subscriber-only podcasts in particular. Can't exist without Friends of Fingers stepping up to underwrite the independent coverage about drinking in America. I really, really appreciate that you did. Okay, without further ado, here's the Fingers Podcast with Benjamin Anderson. Benjamin Anderson, welcome to the Fingers Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Dave. I'm really glad to be here. Thanks for the invite. Looking forward to...
Yes. Benjamin, where are you joining us from?
So I'm in Vancouver, BC, where I am doing my graduate studies at Simon Fraser University, which is in Burnaby, which is a suburb of Vancouver, basically.
I've never been to Vancouver. I want to go someday.
You've got a place to stay, should you choose.
Yeah, you may regret that, but I appreciate the invite even so. Benjamin, thanks so much for coming on the Fingers Podcast. I'm glad you're here today. We got a lot to talk about. By way of introduction, I'd love if you could just give my listeners a quick little background on who you are and what you do. I obviously know, but they might not know. So if you could just let them know what the field of study you work in and your focus, and then we can get rolling.
Great. Yeah. So I'm just about to finish my PhD in communication at Simon Fraser. And my studies involve the working conditions and experiences of workers in industries and firms that brand themselves as craft or artisanal. And a good deal of what that's involved is talking to workers at places like bakeries, like craft breweries, like, well, members of makerspaces, these kinds of things, to get a sense of what this turn toward, in scare quotes, you know, artisanry or craft really means, and whether it's actually a qualitatively different kind of production than, you know, mass production in kind of the more industrial form. In addition to my studies, I also teach in the school, labor studies program at Simon Fraser. I teach classes in labor theory, in social theory, organizing, these kinds of things. And so that kind of maps onto this research as well, because ultimately the project that became my dissertation, which was just submitted 2 days ago.
I had an air horn sound effect, I would play it right.
Well, that's what post is for, right?
Yeah, so. We'll fix it in post. Congratulations. Yeah.
Thank you very much. What the project basically shaped up to be is a kind of activist research where I've been working very closely with workers, particularly in brewing, around building organizational capacity, building class consciousness, looking for inroads into getting folks in a position to be able to fight for better conditions. Because I you know, you're no stranger to all of the bad stuff that seems to plague this industry specifically in terms of sexual harassment, in terms of racism, sexism, heterosexism, you name it. And workers are increasingly pushing back on this. And it's taken a lot of different forms, but the group that I'm involved in, we tend to push more toward, let's find formal ways to come together and push against these conditions. So, you know, less calling for an HR representative, more organizing a union.
What do you mean? The HR representative is not going to help, Ben?
It's an interesting thing. And even in this group, which I'll introduce later, we have discussions about this. Because, like, to a certain degree, if I'm in a workplace and, well, I mean, I'm a cis white guy, so chances of me having this problem are very, very small. But if I'm experiencing harassment or bullying or that kind of thing, and there is an HR person, I should definitely utilize that person. And maybe it is kind of a formal structure to see some individualized response to that issue. But if it's an industry-wide thing, or if it's a toxic workplace, if the bosses are the ones creating the atmosphere and the behavior, you have to have some kind of collective power to push against that, or nothing's ever going to change. The HR person is going to be working for those bosses and insulating them from instituting any kind of real institutional change.
HR is not your friend. They work for the company and not for the workforce. We say Absolutely. It all the time. We'll say it again. But let's back up for a second. I mean, you gave us a great, I think, working definition of kind of, you know, your area of focus. And you mentioned that this industry, when we talk about, you know, the craft brewing industry, is kind of the one that we're focusing on here. And I know you've spent a lot of your time looking at, is an industry that has a lot of problems that are endemic and specific to the industry. You mentioned that, and I want to touch on that in a second. You also mentioned that the production and kind of the way these products come to market and the way they're created and the way, you know, workers interact with them, there's been a distinction to the consumer that makes these products dramatically different than mass-produced goods. Mm-hmm. But that distinction in terms of how they're actually produced maybe is less relevant or maybe harder to make out. And I'm curious, that I think that strikes me as a good place to start, because the question here, you know, to put it a little bit more simply, is craft beer, and we'll use that as the example, craft beer seems different than mass-produced beer to the drinker. How different is it in your view, in your studies, in your activism? How different is that product to the worker?
My interviewees seem to suggest that in terms of like day-to-day work, the difference is negligible. And I mean, we can basically see that by just thinking for a second. Like, beer is a very simple thing to make. I make it in my garage with my buddies, right? It's a simple list of ingredients. The amount of equipment and the kinds of equipment you need, at least at a basic level, is very simple, not very complex. And there's a reason that beer has been around for thousands of years. It's because it's you almost can't mess it up. Obviously we've all had, and I don't know if I publicly should give names, but we've all had like a Coors or a Budweiser or a Molson Canadian, and we know what that's like. And most of us that are interested in craft beer are like, okay, yeah, I'm not going to drink that if I have a choice. And, you know, that comes from a particular approach to mass production that characterized the 20th century, this kind of move towards standardization, the lowest common denominator. Let's make a product that we can make as cheaply as possible and that will, you know, scratch that itch for the biggest number of people.
And it's commodity input and commodity output at that point. There's standardized barley, there's standardized hops, you're getting a certain pH level of water. And the goal is to make the same thing over and over again. And I mean, any of the big macro producers, when they're trying to put lipstick on a pig and you know, make their product seem special and seem, you know, like there's artisanal craftsmanship that goes into it, that is the thing that they will harp on, is that, you know, I've been on the tour down at Budweiser in St. Louis. We can make Budweiser in 12 different locations throughout the country and it will taste exactly the same no matter what. And sure, there is a certain like institutionalized skill or, you know, competency to do that. But, you know, the goal, to your point, is, you know, to churn out outputs that can reach, you know, that have a product market fit that can continually be quenched by that output.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, then we you know, we get to the end of the 20th century. We get into like the late 80s, early 90s, and the flavor of the day is distinction, right? Like marketers and mass producers are starting to see that like difference is important to people. And that, I think, through the 90s and into the 2000s morphs into this kind of distinction of quality, where the consumer is interested in both enjoying a better product, but also kind of displaying this kind of refinement that comes from, you know, being a wine connoisseur or what have you.
Which is a form of social capital, you might call it. I'm sure Absolutely. There may be a more specific academic term, but like what we're talking about is basically a cachet that is divorced from the composition of the liquid and is much more closely wed to the way people consume you consuming the liquid.
Absolutely. And obviously this then maps on top of what becomes the, you know, the micro brew movement and moving into the craft beer movement. On one hand, it is, you know, supplying that specialized commodity that there is demand for now that folks are seeking out that social capital and that distinction. Here we're, you know, if we want to go academic, we can say, you know, we're using like sociological Bourdieu
flex kind of terms. Flex on us.
Yeah. I won't go any deeper than that, especially because then I invite criticism for precision
on these kinds of things. Well, this man is close to his PhD, so we'll just take it. We'll take it as a given that you know the terms, but give us the dummy terms. Give us the man on the street terms, Ben.
Well, so, you know, there is this demand for, I want high quality and I want the things my way, you know, and the, I think that is that Burger King slogan.
Right.
And at the same time, there are a lot of folks who in the 80s and 90s had been brewing in their garages. They'd gotten involved in like the campaign for real ales, and they start to say, you know, there's good stuff to be had, but Molson and Budweiser, and they're not going to make it. So let's go into business. Let's do something different. And all of that, as I think many of us remember, was built around, you know, this terminology of revolution, right? We're resisting the corporate fat cats. We're doing it our own way. But the actual process beyond using better ingredients is about the same. And as these businesses grew, especially into kind of regional craft breweries, we see a kind of a return to the like rationalized mass production process. So if you go into like, I'm trying to think of
Sierra Nevada, Stone,
In other words,
big regional or big national craft breweries, they're operating on a similar template to the macro breweries that are orders of magnitude larger, but nevertheless were once defined in opposition.
Exactly. And then you kind of zoom out and you look at the industry as a whole, like the craft end of the beer industry. And that's being, you know, reproduced everywhere. I mean, obviously there are still small breweries that are, you know, like, you know, two folks in a converted shipping container who are making something. Like, there's this, I interviewed this guy in Portland, give him a shout out, Dan from Moon Shrimp Brewing. He does gluten-free beer, and his brewery is like the lair of a mad scientist. It's a converted, like, I imagine, like, accountant's office or something, and he's jerry-rigged all of this like farm equipment and things that he got for free into brewing equipment, and it's such an amazing setup, and he's a wonderful guy, and we had a really good chat about it.
He's doing like a nano brewery out of like the Better Call Saul offices.
definitely yeah. And he's very much the exception, right? There's not a lot of those folks that are just, it's just him basically. And he brews several days a week and then kind of distributes himself and all this kind of thing. It's kind of punk rock. But more often than not, once you start getting employees, you're going to have what is, I think, an inherent latent conflict between, you know, folks who are just earning a wage and folks who are, you know, reaping the profit. And when we get to kind of medium-sized breweries that are, you know, maybe a head brewer and some folks in the production side. So some assistant brewers, some folks working the canning lines, drivers, warehousers, what have you. And let's even throw a tap room in there, right? So you've got wait staff, you've got maybe a kitchen staff, all this kind of stuff. It's going to inevitably become a hierarchical workplace. And as it does, what I hear from folks who work front of house, who work back of house, those same things that the folks from the so-called craft beer revolution age were fighting against are they're just the business of the day today. And so when you ask someone who's like an assistant brewer, I talked to a guy in Seattle a few years ago who was an assistant brewer at a relatively small craft brewery there, and I asked him straight up, as like, given your wages, given your benefits, if you got an offer from Budweiser to, or I guess InBev tomorrow, what would you say? And he'd say, I would take it in a second.
Sure.
Because I would almost certainly have better benefits. I would have higher wages. I would be a member of a union. And I would have the same level of creative input that I do here. Because one of his big complaints was like, I worked under the head brewer. He writes all the recipes and I just follow his recipes. I don't get to do anything. So that the whole idea of craft for this mm-hmm. guy is false in terms of his working yeah. life, right? He's not a craftsperson. He's someone who follows a recipe. He's a line cook, you know? And I think that increasingly characterizes the attitude that folks who are especially in those kind of support roles tend to mm-hmm. have. I mean, some people are still animated by the cultural cachet of I work in a brewery, right? There is a certain pull to doing that kind of work because it is hip right now. I work in craft beer. I make beer. Oh, that's pretty cool. But another person I interviewed on that trip to Seattle, he said it was fun for a couple months being able to go to a party, bring some beer I made and say, hey, yeah, I'm a craft right. brewer. But at the end of the day, what he would rather have is a 401k, higher paycheck. Yeah.
Health insurance. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, like, there's a lot wrapped up in what you just kind of held forth about. And I want to unpack a couple different pieces of sure. it. The first thing, I mean, I talk about and have written about, and, you know, people who listen to the podcast or read my work will know sort of where I'm going with this. But what I refer to, sort of what you're describing, is the dream job paradox, right? It's like, this is this amazing yep. industry to work in. There's an enormous amount of color, amount of creativity, amount of dynamism, because that's how the consumer perceives it. When you walk into a mm-hmm. bar and you see awesome tap handles, or you walk into a cool beer shop and you see all the cool different labels, and people have an emotional connection to that product as consumers. So then they assume that, well, shit, that's got to be an amazing job to do, right? Like, I would love yep. to work in a brewery. I fucking hate my job as a project manager. I wish that I could be, you know, brewing beer all day, right? So it sounds like a dream job. But when you actually talk to workers in the industry, quite often they will tell you sort of a version of what you've heard from, you know, the folks that you interviewed. I've certainly heard this from workers that I've interviewed, which is like, yeah, it's a fucking job, man. Like, it's... It yep. is like moderately cool at first, and then it's way less cool, you know, a couple months in when I have, yeah, low fills that I get for free every week, but I can't pay my rent with low fills. Like I need money to pay.
Yeah.
I'm curious to hear. I mean, you recently published an article, I guess a couple months ago, called The Forgotten Labor of Craft, Exploitation and Organizing in Artisanal Industries. And in it, you write about, I think you called it like the profound disconnect. And it strikes me that there's a profound disconnect between how we think about the industry or craft industries generally as consumers and how workers experience them. And I'm wondering, you know, in your research and as you've written and thought about this, how is that disconnect or that, you know, kind of tension changing how workers think about their product and their labor?
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, and I think it's kind of mediated along a couple of lines. Most young folks that I interviewed, I should say, like in this research, I formally interviewed 35 people. And that's some brewery owners, that's some brewery workers, that's cafe workers, that's, you know, self-build makers and artisans.
The butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And in addition to that, like I've had a ton of informal conversations that aren't formally part of the research. But so when I make generalizations, I'm pulling on those 35, but then also this kind of ecosystem of folks that I'm now connected with and the discussions that we have kind of off the record, obviously not quoting those people. When you talk to younger folks in craft beer specifically, a lot of them were brought in by that that allure, that idea of a cool job. And some of them maintain that to this day, right? It's just like, I love this industry, I'm passionate about it. But an equal number find themselves quite jaded pretty quick. And I think this is particularly the case for folks who are working in the tap room, or folks who have more menial jobs back of house, you know, the folks who are, you know, cleaning and stacking kegs and running the canning line and these kinds of things. As that allure breaks down for a lot of these folks, they, at least in the formal conversations that I've had, many of them start to think of this not as some kind of creative endeavor the way that that I think we all do. You know, that you think that, you know, behind the curtain at the craft brew house is, you know, a bunch of folks in leather aprons with twisty mustaches, like dipping little glass vials into barrels and then tasting it and smacking their lips or whatever, right?
Right. And also, like, yeah, singing along to like the Avid Brothers or something, yeah, doing like the stomp clap music.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But as the veneer wears off for these folks, they increasingly start to think about their jobs as warehousing jobs, as industrial jobs, as factory work. And in my research, what I see coming out of that, based on kind of this same trend in other industries, is a very ripe potential for folks to start banding together to demand better conditions. Because once you start thinking of yourself as a worker who has everything in common with other workers rather than a creative artisan, you probably are in a better position to find those that common ground and actually start talking about your interests and the interests of your coworkers and start really pushing for those. And so a lot of the folks that I talked to who have been involved in pushes to improve their workplaces had that realization relatively early on. And in doing so and talking about that realization with their coworkers, they were able to settle on some common ground. And that's when you start seeing things like union pushes or social media campaigns against particular employers saying, hey, why is this serial sexual abuser still working in the kitchen? Or why is this owner still part of your ownership group when they're making transphobic comments online or what have you? And I think it starts with that realization that, like, this workplace is only as good as we force it to be. And you're not going to get there if you're still living the twisty mustache fantasy.
Right. Nothing against twisty mustaches, though. Yeah. Twisty mustaches are, they're comrades until proven otherwise.
But yeah, I this is mostly spoken out of jealousy. My mustache will never rival a twisty mustache.
Well, we'll accept you with open arms anyway. I want to, the idea of workers shifting to see themselves more aligned with their fellow craft workers as opposed to owners of the business that they work at seems to me to be extremely significant, but also pretty tough to exactly kind of like define. And the reason I say that is because a lot of the reporting that I do when I talk to workers, I hear certainly discontent with their experiences laboring in craft breweries and craft industries. But I also hear aspirations to one day open their own brewery, to one day become the owner with whom they're frustrated, and then they'll do it their way. And I don't think in a lot of cases, and this is not meant to, you know, neg the workers that I talk to, I just don't think, especially in America and probably to some extent in Canada as well, there is not much class analysis that goes into the way we think about work. But that is a shift that a lot of workers start out in this industry pursuing, right? Once I get enough money to open my own brewery, then things get better. Mm-hmm. And that's a different trajectory than staying as a worker and building solidarity. And I'm curious to hear you unpack, if you're able, or, you know, maybe this is kind of an unanswerable question, but why do some workers wind up on one trajectory and some on the other? What's what is the significance of having that owner aspiration, you know, from a worker who may otherwise be persuaded by an organizing conversation?
Yeah, it's I mean, it is a a very difficult question, and we won't come to, you know, the correct answer here, but this drive toward entrepreneurialism is built into the very DNA of craft beer. I mean, this is an industrial sector that has centered its myth making on, you know, the self-made entrepreneur. You know, we know the stories of Fritz Maytag, or he's the only name I'm going to be able to drop, but like the Dogfish Head guy and
Sam Calagione, Ken Grossman at Sierra Nevada. Sure, like these are the titans of the industry. Dick Leinenkugel, which by the way, what a fun name. but yeah, sure, the self-made owner. Now, mind you, in pretty much all cases, I know Fritz Maytag in particular was an heir to the Maytag fortune. Yeah. So self-made is the wrong word, but you're right. Like kind of these, like, you know, firebrand, well, fuck that. I'm going to do it my way. Yeah. I don't care if they say I'm not going to make money on this. Like I believe in myself type of thing. And you're right. Like that, I think myth is a good way to describe that body of history or storytelling around the industry.
Yeah. And like we've all, I think if we're followers of, you know, craft beverage, we know these stories to varying degrees, and we've kind of picked them up almost through osmosis over the years. And in the early days of micro and craft, there was actually that career trajectory, right? You worked at Widmer for long enough, and then you opened up your own brew house in Portland, or, you know, or you did the same thing with Stone or what have you. And a lot of the places that we, you know, frequent, or the beers we drink, kind of come from that, you know, trajectory from those brewers. But increasingly, in a place like, so I'm in Vancouver, BC, the likelihood of you being able to open your own brewery, like, how you're going to save like $3-4 million to outfit a brewery. Like this is the playground of investors and the ultra wealthy. There's so much investment money built into this that even folks that are on that entrepreneurial trajectory, I think, are going to get a wake up call when they start doing the business. One of my participants ran a facility and tap room in Portland, and basically he worked 70-hour weeks, didn't earn a wage, and then eventually his investors called in the debt, and it's just like that was all for nothing, you know. Wow. I was trying to anonymize it a little bit there.
Yeah, sure.
But so it, like, in major cities, in places with high costs of living and, you know, middling wages, the likelihood of a worker being able to realize that dream is pretty small. It might be a little bit different for someone who is willing to do, you know, take on their entrepreneurial activity by going to, you know, a small town somewhere that doesn't currently have a craft brewery. There's still that option. But I think that escape route, that escape hatch, is probably not very realistic for a lot of people, even if they're still kind of pursuing it.
Yeah.
But I think that you pursue that kind of dream for long enough, and you're going to start to see that, you know, maybe it's not realistic. And then you start thinking, well, I've been, you know, head brewer at my brewery for, you know, 7-8 years now, and I make a lot less than my friends who work in similar industries or who work for, you know, a big macro.
Yep.
And maybe I get a little bit bitter, and maybe I start, you know, talking about it. And like, that doesn't necessarily mean that there's going to be an automatic translation of that into a desire for, you know, kind of collective organizing or anything like that. But I
what
do
else
think
could it? Sorry to interrupt, but just to kind of draw that out for a second, what else could it translate into? You know, certainly we know when it translates into a union drive, because we see those eventually. Mm-hmm. What are the other, like, sort of pathways there? Mm-hmm. I mean, one that strikes me is just kind of like a nihilism, like cynicism type of thing, where you're still atomized and you just kind of go to ground.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine that's probably the most common. Maybe even we might be able to, and I don't have data for this, this is all speculation,
sure,
but like we might even be able to draw a line to those toxic conditions, right?
Interesting.
You're fed up with your situation and the fact that there is no upward mobility, and maybe you just act out.
Yeah.
You know, that's very simplistic, and I don't want folks to come away saying this is my theory, but there's probably some kind of correlation between the kinds of toxic behavior that characterize this industry and the poor conditions, the poor pay, the lack of benefits that characterize the industry, you know?
Mm-hmm. So, sorry, I interrupted you there, but yeah, you were making the point that if you're you're working and you've been in the industry for a while and you see the window closing, or maybe it already has closed depending on the market you're in, for the opportunity for you to open your own brewery, because to your point, finance capital is really the only way you're able to do this. And that takes on a dimension that many workers, even if they have entrepreneurial aspirations, are really not prepared to take on, or they don't want to take the risk because they have, you know, other personal factors that make it unattractive or whatever. So then they find themselves in a situation where, okay, I have a job that, you know, is not paying enough, or the conditions aren't good enough, or, you know, they could be better. And that's where, you know, if they don't go the cynicism route, the nihilism route, that's where we start to see some of the collective action conversations begin, right? And you've covered this extensively. I know there's been a lot of organizing, or at least some organizing, in BC and in Vancouver specifically. Like, what is the, in your research, like, what does the contour of that conversation, or the trajectory of that conversation, look like? I mean, are you, you know, here in the US, I know how organizing looks. It's typically one guy gets fucking fed up enough and makes a call to the only union that he's heard of, right? Like, because most people in the US have not, you know, interacted with unions, unfortunately. What is the situation like, you know, that you've covered in Vancouver, in the Vancouver scene?
So in BC, there haven't been a lot of successes in organizing craft breweries specifically, in recent memory at least. There's so the most recent drive, a successful drive, was at a brewery called Turning Point Brewing, which is in Delta, I believe, which is a suburb. Turning Point is a contract brewer. It's not even a craft brewery necessarily. They make craft beer, but they are owned by Labatt. This was kind of a hot shop model where throughout the pandemic, the brewery made record profits, and the workers had not received a cost of living increase in years and years. Mm-hmm. And so the managers called this meeting, a big announcement. We're really excited to make this announcement. So they get everyone into this meeting, and the announcement is a 1% wage increase. And everyone... Everyone left the meeting saying, well, fuck this, like, we really need a union. And so several of them joined together, and they made that happen. They reached out to the main union organizing in the brewing sector in Canada, which is SEIU, and very quickly turned that into a card signing campaign, and then had their successful, this is the way in BC, it's different everywhere, obviously. They signed membership cards, met the threshold there, had a vote, approved the union overwhelmingly. They're currently in bargaining for their first contract. It seems to be that the anti-union playbook today is with a new union, delay, and just try and whittle away, you know, that collectivity and that desire for change.
Is that as easy to do in Canada as it is in the US? I mean, the US, like, corporation just presses the no union button and the courts just fucking bog it down until all the workers leave. It's pretty much like that transactional. My understanding was that it was a little better in Canada, but maybe not.
It might be nominally, but it's still the tactic that they're all using. And that's not industry specific, right? Right. Like, that just seems to be this is tactic number one after you lost the fight and your workers decided to unionize.
Right.
Well, yeah, let's make it hell for them.
Well, that's actually an interesting point, right? Is because that goes back to the conversation about how customers or how drinkers see the product versus how workers experience making the product. But it, you know, it's very revealing that no matter how much veneer of progressivism or, you know, community orientation or, you know, environmental protectionism, whatever the values are that you ascribe to craft breweries, as soon as the chips are down and workers want a union, the playbook that an anti-union craft brewery runs is the same playbook that a Fortune 500 manufacturing firm runs. They're not different, right? And that, so that reveals that, like, no matter how distinguished or differentiated the product is on the shelves, the ownership class and their mentality towards organized labor is not articulated whatsoever from much larger corporations, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's interesting too, because there's a market segment that a smart craft brewery could dominate right now, and that is people like me who will be like, yeah, there's a union bug on your beer. It says union made on it. I'm going to buy that. So, like, there's got to be one smart business owner out there who's like, okay, my employees are unionizing. How do I make this work for me? Do I fight the union, or do I just put union made on the fucking label and actually, you know, use it as a marketing tool? And I'm surprised that nobody's done it.
You see a little bit of it, right? Like, you, or at least in the US, the one that comes to mind most immediately is Fair State Brewing Cooperative, and their situation is a little different because they were worker-owned to begin with. But, you know, they earned voluntary recognition from owner, and they had a contentious, but ultimately, from what I understand based on my sources, amicable and productive bargaining process, ratified a contract.
Nice.
And now they make their bones, to some extent, off marketing. We are union-made. We are proud of being union-made. And it's a compelling marketing message, especially at a time when pro-union sentiment in the U.S., at least, is at its highest since the 70s, right? Yeah. So your point is well made. It's like, shit, man, like, maybe just, like, you know, be cool.
Totally.
And we rarely see it. It's
interesting too, because, like, corporations and small businesses are very open to kind of cynically appropriating identity, right?
Yeah.
Like,
they will greenwash, they will pinkwash, but they will not redwash.
Yeah, yeah. And it is interesting because, yeah, as we're seeing with this wave of organization through the U.S., you know, Starbucks has kind of really shown it, it's unmasked itself in such a clear way with its union busting activities, where it just demonstrates, as you were saying before, that lack of commitment. And you see the same thing with the identity washing, right? Like, to put an example to it, I interviewed several workers who work at an artisan bakery and coffee shop here in Vancouver. It's a chain, and it bills itself as a community space, and particularly a safe space for LGBTQ folks. And it hires a lot of trans folks, a lot of queer folks, and particularly, like, trans folks of color. And when these workers started seeing that they were being, you know, massively exploited, especially for their identity, to kind of build this brand for the bakery, they pushed back. And they're like, you know, we need you to commit to some, you know, improvements in our working
material
lives.
Gains.
Yeah. they ended up people started getting fired. And so then they organized and they joined the UFCW, United Food and Commercial Workers, basically along those lines, saying, you know, your social capital, your ability to brand yourself as a safe space for LGBTQ people is all down to us. You know, we're the ones that made that. It's not you.
Mm-hmm.
And you owe us something, right? You've basically turned our identities into commodities. These things are all related, right? And it just kind of goes to show that these companies, be they craft breweries or bakeries or coffee shops or what have you, that are branding themselves as progressive, as community spaces, when the rubber hits the road, they're gonna jettison all that stuff, because ultimately what matters is the profits, is paying off the investors, etc. And I guess ultimately the point being that the only way to hold them to this public image of care and community is to demand it through collective action.
Right. Because the company, whatever company it may be, if they're in the craft sector and they find that marketing message compelling, which most breweries do, yep, I would say, most coffee shops, et cetera, we're community oriented, we're local, all that good shit that consumers like, they can't jettison that message from the consumer, because consumers genuinely want that stuff and are willing to pay more for products that, you know, carry those markers. Now, whether those things are actually quote unquote worth those markers, that's a different conversation entirely, but that's what a drinker wants. You know, we know that local is super important to the American drinker, even at a point when craft beer has kind of lost some of its cool factor in this market. People still want to drink local beer.
Absolutely.
And, you know, you can't then outsource, you know, the beer that you're producing to a cheaper factory across state lines or, you know, and ship it in, right? Like, that wouldn't be living your values, and workers would call you out for it. Similar with regards to, you know, identity politics and monetizing them as marketing materials. You can't lay off all of your trans workers or refuse to pay for, you know, gender reassignment surgery as part of, like, healthcare benefits. But then when Pride rolls around, get them out front, you know, for the come get your equality bagel or whatever.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
This is something that comes up a lot in my reporting and, you know, also comes up for me personally as someone who's, you know, worked in the digital media space. I organized my workplace at one point and certainly, you know, this came up. We faced it as an organizing challenge. It comes up a lot in craft breweries because of the size of the shops and because of some of the us versus them mentality that we spoke to and the sort of entrepreneurial mythology by which this sector came to be.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm getting at here is the idea that, you know, the company and the workers and the owners together are one big family, right? That we're all in this together. Let's not organize. You guys shouldn't organize. It wouldn't be right. Yeah. Or, you know, a lot of times workers will say this to me. This is their sentiment. It's like, I would never want to do that to, you know, Mike. Like Mike gave me my first job and like, you know, that would crush him. I know he doesn't make that much money. That just wouldn't be right.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, you know, you've worked in this space, you've been studying it for a while, you got the dissertation coming. I'm sure this has come up. Can you help me understand? I mean, I'm not trying to condescend to those workers because I also have these impulses as a worker. Can you help me like unpack what's going on there emotionally, right? Like it's because it's very, in my opinion, it's very pernicious, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's a powerful sentiment and it often acts as a bulwark against collective action on behalf of workers, you know, pointed at owners.
Yeah. I think that this misconception that to organize, to create a union is to attack or to hurt the owner of the company is so deeply ingrained in North American culture. And it's, I think it probably finds roots in business reporting through the 70s, 80s, and 90s. There's a really good book called Framed by Christopher Martin. And it's about the mass media, particularly the kind of journalistic framing of labor through the late part of the 20th century. And ultimately, through the various case studies that Martin does, he demonstrates the ways in which certain myths about unions became kind of the
received knowledge.
Yeah, received knowledge, kind of commonsensical notions. And one of the biggest,
I think, was the baseline, at least.
Yeah. Right?
And you had to disprove that before you could have a conversation about labor, rather
absolutely.
Than someone had to prove it before you could have a conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think one of the most pervasive, and as you say, the automatic one you hear is like, we can't organize, the owner, Jeff, can't afford it. And like, my first interview in this project, it was with an assistant brewer at a small brewery in the suburb of Vancouver. It's got a lot of great breweries and I can't conjure the name of it right now, but we're sitting in the tap room and I ask him specifically about like, would you join a union? And he said, yeah, absolutely. I would join a union in a heartbeat. And then I asked, well, would you organize a union? And he said, well, no, because like we're a really small shop and I just don't think it'd be viable here because like the owners, you know, they don't have that much. And it's interesting, right? Because there's this desire to have that kind of collective power, but then this hesitancy because, well, I don't want to ruffle feathers. I don't want to hurt anybody. And I think we all need to recognize that like organizing the union is only the first step, right? Because then what's going to happen is after you've organized the union, after you've voted it into existence, well, then you bargain with the employer, right? And there's nothing that says that in that bargaining, you have to say, we all need 50% raises, right? It might not
all your money. Yeah.
it might not cost them a penny. And if your relationship is as good as you're defaulting to, then there's nothing that either party has to worry about, right? Because this is going to be good for the workers. And then, hell, it could be very good for the owners too, because now they can put union made on the label, like we were saying. And so, sure. Like...
And also, you know, to some extent, like, you know, we spoke about HR at the beginning of this conversation, HR is not always the most effective way to address workplace issues.
Yeah.
Unions at, you know, in some shops are a effective infrastructure to address problems within the ranks, right?
Absolutely.
So there are there are, you know, second order benefits to an organized workforce that now naturally that does not get covered in, you know, mainstream media barely at all.
No, we get the other narrative, which is, you know, protecting the bad workers, right? Which it is,
that's right.
I mean, that does exist, obviously, because when you have big institutions, these kinds of corrupt practices can happen, but it's very much the exception. But again, like the framing of labor in our culture over the last 20, 30 years has been one of demonizing, you know, the lazy worker who's kept their job for 40 years sneaking by because the union protects them.
Right.
Which is not the case.
And he has 13 weeks of vacation.
Yeah.
Right. Well, do you think that that's changed? I mean, like, one of the things that occurs to me as a critique of a mainstream critique, an uninformed critique maybe, but certainly a potent one of labor organizing in the craft space is that these are not working class workers. They are educated workers. They are white, overwhelmingly white workers. They could be doing knowledge work jobs. They have chosen passion industries. So they ought not even have a union because that's not for them.
The reasoning feels really sound there, actually. And it is a challenge, I think, because the places that have successfully organized in Canada, at least, tend to be those places that have a more diverse workforce and particularly a more working class workforce. So like Turning Point, a great deal of their workers are permanent residents rather than citizens. They're immigrants, a lot of them, a lot more people of color than you'd see at, you know, your East Vancouver, like hip brewery. And I think that there's something very important in considering those intersections in what an organizable workplace looks like. And as you say, like, so many people in craft brewing of the, you know, kind of cis white man variety are coming from a middle class elective manual labor kind of position, which is, it's always going to be a challenge. That said, I talked to a coffee shop worker. I think he was a barista who worked and I think still works at a chain of schmancy coffee shops here in Vancouver. And they organized also with UFCW a few years back. And he had something very interesting to say about it. Because he said that there's a challenge here in our shop in that several people have picked coffee work as a lifestyle. And so you have these middle-class folks who are commuting in from the house, you know, their parents' house in the suburbs. They don't have to do this. They elect to do it. And how did we organize well with those people? And part of it, like, is just kind of listening to what those folks are not digging about their work, right? Because although class is the central ingredient when we're talking about, you know, building collective power, there are still interests that workers with middle class mentalities will likely have. I mean, workplaces often suck, and there's a lot of things that we could collectively improve about them beyond those narrow considerations that we, you know, kind of automatically go for, right? And like here in Canada, it's different than the U.S. In that we have universal health care, right? But what we don't have is universal dental, universal mental health care, universal pharma care. That stuff is tied to your employer. And a lot of employers, especially in these kinds of like service and artisan types of sectors, they don't provide that stuff. And so even if you're, you know, from that kind of, you know, elective manual labor camp, having access to healthy teeth might be something that you're interested in, you know, hopefully. And so I don't know. It's not a clean answer. I don't have a good answer for that one. It's something I'm still trying to figure out myself, because I think it is one of the main challenges.
Well, but I think the point is well taken. If I could try to tease it out maybe a little bit more, is like making common cause with coworkers is not just along the lines of class, as we've seen, like identity and condition can be quite powerful as well. So, you know, it's certainly, to your point, like it's a little bit murky, a little bit of a gray area, and
absolutely
a difficult organizing challenge, but not necessarily like a fatal one, to, you know, to try to overcome. Yeah. Ben, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us today. We've covered a lot of ground with regards to organizing in the craft space. For people who are listening who want to find more of your work, want to read more of what you've written on this, where can they track you down?
It's the kind of question that I probably should have prepared for.
They can come to your office at Simon Fraser University.
Yeah. My office is in the academic quadrangle on the Burnaby campus of Simon Fraser University.
Are you on Twitter?
I'm drawing a bit of a blank, to be honest. I don't use it. I steer clear of social media.
Yeah, God forbid you get your hands dirty with social media up in the ivory tower of academia. Yeah.
I mean, because it's so Googleable, I'll say that you can reach me at my email address at Simon Fraser, which is bja19@sfu.ca. Happy to chat with folks. I should also mention, and I alluded to this at the top and then never came back to it, I'm part of a group called the Craft Brewery Workers Alliance of Canada that is organizing basically capacity building events for workers in the craft brewing sector in Canada. And you can find us at Craft Beer Worker on Instagram. You can also go to CBWAC.ca to find our webpage, and you can connect with us there. I think it's an innovative model toward organizing, and it's one that I'm quite passionate about. I'm not a worker in the industry. I'm not playing a central part, but I've been very impressed with the work that these folks are doing, and you should definitely connect.
You're not a worker in the industry. You're an outside agitator.
Exactly. Yeah. I write agitprop and show up to events, rabble rouse.
All right. That was the Fingers Podcast with Benjamin Anderson. Hopefully you found the interview as interesting as I did. If you want to hear more of Ben's thoughts about organizing in the craft industries, you can read his work at the links available on the web version of this post at fingers.substack.com, or you can just email him at bja19@sfu.ca. Shout out to Ben for just giving out his email address to the Fingers faithful. Really appreciate it, man. If you're interested in checking out the Craft Brewery Workers Alliance of Canada, which you mentioned towards the beginning and very end of this episode, you can also find them at cbwac.ca. That's cbwac.ca. One more big thanks to Ben for coming on the Fingers Podcast, and big thanks to you, yes you, for supporting the Booze Letter with your paid subscription. Only friends of Fingers have access to this episode, so make sure you share it on your social media so everyone else realizes that they're missing out and decides to pony up. Signing off from Fingers HQ, it's your fearless Fingers editor, Dave Infante, reminding you that the twirly mustache myth may die hard, but it does eventually die. We all do. Bye-bye.